Welcome to Real Jam Radio. This is Daniel Leroux, your host, and so happy to have you with us. This episode is with Jared Weiss, who covers the Boston Celtics for CLNS Radio and Celtics Blog, and he and I have known each other for a few years now, and I wanted to talk about the Celtics because they've been a part of a flurry of different moves, from trading Rajon Rondo to trading almost all of the guys they traded Rajon Rondo for, and I was interested in how that has played in Boston, because as somebody who isn't in that area, I do find it very interesting to see how that has played there, plus all the other storylines with Brad Stevens and everything else. And so we started there, I think that runs about half an hour, and then we get on to broader NBA topics, talk about the Warriors a little while and some of the other things that he's been noticing around the league. The whole conversation runs a little over an hour, so hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's always fun to be here.
It's pretty funny because I think it was about a month ago I had talked initially with you about trying to come on to talk about what looked like it was going to be a Celtics trade, and now we have plenty of trades to talk about. So as somebody who's been around this team so much, do you want to talk about how the last month has been?
It's crazy. I mean, so when I cover the team in my nightly show, we usually do the first episode is like the first part of our episode is breaking down the game that happened. And the second part is kind of looking at the more macro level stuff that's going on. And we're kind of doing the same topic a lot of the time, but we're doing completely new material every time because the main focus has just been the new identity, the Celtics, but it changes so often. Like I'm holding up in front of me this sheet that the team gave us where they broke down all the draft picks. And it's this really great spreadsheet. It fills up an entire 8.5 by 11 piece of paper with all the draft picks they have from 2015 to 2020. It's unbelievable. They could have 11 first rounders in the near future. I mean, it's unbelievable what they're doing. But on the court, they have like such a major identity crisis. Offensively, they're trying to figure it out game by game. They don't have a go-to guy right now. Jared Sullinger should be their go-to guy, but I've asked Jared Sullinger about 5 times over the last 2 weeks if he wants to be the go-to guy on this team, and he's like, no, we just got to have a system. I don't want to be that guy. I think the guys that are now leaders on this team that were really the followers before but now are being forced to be leaders, they're trying to really emphasize that they want to focus on the team system and building the system and all that. But if that's fine if they want to develop this team, which is what they should be doing. But as far as winning games right now, they really need a guy that can take them through a quarter. And right now that's Evan Turner on occasions, that's Jared Sullinger on occasions. But it's, as you can imagine, saying that Evan Turner and Jared Sullinger are the guys that are going to carry your team is not really a recipe for success. And that's why they don't really win anymore. And they're 3-7 in the last 10 games. And it's not going to get any better anytime soon.
And what's so kind of compelling for me with this Celtics team, and it's hilarious how that has changed despite all the turnover, or that hasn't changed despite all turnovers. You and I talked before the season, and the question that I had for you was, who on this team do you see as being around long term? And from what I remember, there was a lot of uncertainty there. There was a lot of, you know, hopefully it's Marcus Smart, hopefully it's Jared Sullinger, but we don't really know. How do you feel on that now? We're about halfway through the season. Who do you think is you would expect to be on this team, let's say 3 years from right now?
Oh, 3 years from now. Smart's the only one that I would lock in as staying 3 years from now. And James Young, too. I mean, James Young has shown a few flashes of brilliance here. I was pushing really hard for him to get some playing time, and thankfully the trades finally opened that up for him. He's getting some run, and he looks pretty good when he's out there. I mean, the guy isn't ready to be in the rotation yet, but just to give him 10 minutes a night, he's pretty valuable. But, I mean, Sullinger is definitely not – he's not progressing in a straight uphill level on the, if you look at the line chart of his progression. I mean, he was a guy that the leap from year one to year two was really good. I mean, he went from in year one where he was kind of a little bit stuck in the mud and all that to year two. It's kind of like a lot of second year players where they figure out how they can start to kind of be themselves in the league and show their personalities both in the way that they play and then who they actually are as a person. And Sullinger finally did that last year. He started moving with the ball more. He started shooting the ball. And this year, the big difference I would say was last year he was hucking up threes and he shot like 26%. And people are criticizing that, which I didn't understand because the Celtics weren't going to win any games last year. So you might as well have all these guys miss all the shots that you want them to make in the future. And sure enough, it works because now Jared Sullinger is a much better three-point shooter. And he is right now probably the best three-point shooter on this team. I mean, the numbers technically don't bear that out. But if you look at the guys that are taking the shots, he's hitting them probably a little bit more than anybody else in this team. And obviously that kind of explains what their biggest weakness is, which is outside shooting. But Solinger, he hasn't really opened up his post game a lot yet. And that's kind of the next evolution for him. Is we know he has a good post game. He's got a solid back to the basket game. He can face up guys from 15 feet, but he just hasn't really gone to it that consistently yet. He's not a guy that you can put him to work on the block. I remember there was a game where Al Jefferson came to town, and I thought that would be a chance for Solinger to really kind of go at Al Jefferson and show off some of his post skills. And Jefferson just ripped him to pieces, and he didn't really have much of an answer for it. So that's a one way in which Solinger kind of needs to grow. And then the other way is just kind of he needs to get in better shape, and he needs to be a better defender. I mean, he needs to try harder on defense. You know, he was criticizing the team as a whole for not playing hard on defense in a game pretty recently. And then I went back to the tape and saw that he was the guy that was really blowing it defensively more than anybody else. So I wouldn't necessarily call that being calling a spade or the pot calling the kettle black, but it's still an area of concern where you have a guy calling out the team for something that he isn't doing either. The team is in desperate need of someone that can lead by example and not just by words, and they don't really have that at all right now.
Do you feel more comfortable with Solinger playing not as the rim protector? Because it seems to me that when you play either Solinger or Olynyk in the ideal circumstance, obviously they're years from that, they have 11 picks to try to get it, but do you see both of them as being better with a rim protector as opposed to trying to eventually become that guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, Jared Solinger playing the five, which doesn't really happen that much right now, thankfully, but that's kind of like when Glenn Davis was playing the five for this team. He was next to Kevin Garnett, which made it work. And Big Baby, even though he can't really protect the rim necessarily, he's a good on-ball defender, and he works his butt off on defense, despite the criticisms that I think were unfair to him. And he's strong, and he rebounds, and he boxes out. And Solinger does most of those things, too. Solinger, when he's guarding the rim, he unfortunately isn't playing next to Kevin Garnett, so he doesn't get the kind of support that Big Baby got that allowed him to be moderately successful in that endeavor. You know, he's playing next to Tyler Zeller, who has definitely made strides as a defensive center. I know my friend Kevin O'Connor from Celtics Blog wrote a really good piece breaking that down. If you're not reading Kevin O'Connor, if you want to know about how the Celtics are playing, he's the guy to go to at Celtics Blog. But they don't have the support. They don't have like defensive anchors on this team right now. Your defensive anchor doesn't always have to be the guy under the rim or guarding LeBron or stuff like that. You need one good defensive player that can allow the other defenders to kind of stay in their space and not need to be constantly recovering and stuff like that. And Kevin Garnett allowed this team, when they had other bad defenders on the floor, he allowed them to still be successful because he did so much himself that it took the pressure off of the other guys. And right now, this team doesn't really have that. I know Avery Bradley, his defense hasn't really stood out the way it has in the past, but he's still been pretty solid, although there have been a few games recently, most notably right before we started talking, the Chicago Bulls game, where Derrick Rose had the best game that I've seen him play this year, although I know he's had a few other really good games. But you know, Bradley isn't really carrying the team defensively like he used to. And while they're not a bad defensive team, they're not really a good one either. And it's really, I think their best defensive nights tend to come against more mediocre teams, really. So the stats probably show that they have a pretty decent defensive rating. But I think that's probably that just their schedule has been kind of serving towards that number.
And what you're saying there makes a lot of sense as somebody who's has background with the Warriors, because what happened with them is there were a lot of players that had that negative defensive perception around the league. And as soon as they got Andrew Bogut and he really got installed, then those became less of issues, because what a rim protector does is they don't prevent mistakes from being made, they just make them less important. And yeah, so they reduce that, and so it allows the mistakes that happen. Like, that's one of the really interesting things that people have been trying to figure out with Anthony Davis defensively, is that he doesn't prevent their terrible perimeter defenders and preventing guys from coming in the lane. The hope is that they make less shots and they're more scared when they do it. And so I think that you need that, and then ideally you have a perimeter defender who can slow down the other team's best player. If you have those two, I think you're all right. And hopefully Avery Bradley can be that guy. Hopefully Marcus Smart can be that guy. But the Celtics have this fascinating dynamic, because the lack of, I guess you'd call it the lack of continuity, but at the same time, is it still acknowledged in the Boston community that Brad Stevens seems like a really good coach?
Well, that's actually been a little bit at risk, that reputation, because, and blame Brad, because Brad has been publicly whipping himself in the back basically lately. He had a press conference where they had a pretty ugly loss where they were in contention for a little while and then they just like completely collapsed. And Brad actually went on stage and said that I'm doing a bad job. And he was saying it very, very deliberately. It was very, he was very emphatic in the way that he was saying it. It was remarkable to see it. And, you know, Stevens, he's so honest. It's amazing. And I think he needs to hang out with Doc and Pop a little bit more to kind of learn how to manipulate the media. It's great for me. It's great for any of us that are covering the team because we get amazing quotes from him that are very detailed and very game specific and very analytical and all that kind of stuff. And incredibly honest. And I love it. But frankly, if I'm in Brad's shoes, I don't think I would be so forthcoming because he's kind of setting himself up here a little bit. Now, he probably has a vote of confidence from Danny Ainge, who basically told him, Brad, we're going to screw this team up for a while now. You're golden. Don't worry. We're going to pay you. We're going to keep you because we know that once this team gets itself together, you're going to turn them into a great team. And of course, David Blatt is kind of going through something similar right now where he has this team that's been put together that while their talent is out of this world, they're clearly a discombobulated roster right now. And he's trying to figure out how to make it work. And I think Mike Miller just today, we're recording on a Sunday, came out and said that, yeah, it's not really working right now. And it's not showing up on the stat sheet, but Blatt's concepts are still genius and we still believe in them. And I think that's the same thing with Brad Stevens, where Brad Stevens' concepts are still very, very forward thinking. I mean, it seems like philosophy is kind of a big deal with him, not in the way that the Zen master works, but just a matter of mental health and all that being a major part of the game and all that, and strategy as much as just trying to be a good, like a good basketball team, but trying to have the right mindset and all that kind of stuff. That's something that Stevens seems to emphasize very heavily. That's been the major theme of this team so far. It's not about execution as much as believing in yourself and all that kind of fluffy stuff. But Stevens takes that fluffy stuff and he tries to make it legitimate. And it's not really working on a team where guys are getting the pink slip every other day and you're constantly rotating in new guys that haven't had the time to really develop it. But once stability is put into this roster, I think that's when you're going to see the results come.
Yeah, one thing that actually is kind of nice about bouncing in on teams at various points, you know, being somebody with national interests who's based in a specific area, is that I think you get a pretty good sense of which teams are well coached and which teams are not. And the most interesting one to me with that this year is the Sacramento Kings. I thought when Mike Malone was there, they were really well coached, and I haven't watched enough of them after to see if Ty Corbin's doing the same thing. But when I watch the Celtics in person or when I watch them on TV, they seem like a well-coached team. Their problems are just that their talent doesn't make much sense and they're just not as good as a lot of other NBA teams. To me, that means that you have a foundation there, and as long as he doesn't lose the locker room, which from what I can tell, it doesn't appear to be much of a problem, that you just need to find, the most important part of this is you need to find the guys who you want to indoctrinate and get them in, and so those are the standard bearers moving forward. And some of that's luck, you know, some of that's just getting the right place at the right time. The Warriors had that with Stephen Curry. And part of it is identifying people and coalescing your assets into a smaller number of people and saying, these are our guys.
Well, you know, the biggest thing when it comes to the coach is whether or not the players want him there. And when Sacramento was in town, I talked to some people and they were telling me that the Kings players were furious that Mike Malone got fired. They did not want him to go, that it was really just management was trying to angle him out pretty much from the start just because they wanted an analytics guy that D'Alessandro could really control. And I wouldn't be surprised if Mullen ends up taking over there next year. But the players have responded as poorly as imaginable to the Malone firing. And the Celtics are in a similar situation there where they're with this coach that they really, really like. And it doesn't seem like he's able to get the most out of them yet. But I honestly, like I said before, I wouldn't put that on Stevens right now. I think Stevens is just what he's working with. He's kind of working with nothing right now. He's got a couple, it's like playing poker with like a pair of threes. It's like you're trying to make something happen with it, but you just don't really have much. And, you know, Stevens, if you're going to judge him, I would judge him based on, one, how the players are continuously supporting him. I don't think there's been any wavering in the support that he's gotten from his team. Even Brandon Bass, who is one of the most professional people I've ever interacted with in my life, he kind of started to complain a little bit about the lack of playing time that he was getting, but he was still incredibly respectful to his coach. And, you know, there's, I mean, Brandon Bass is probably the last guy that would criticize his coach, but there's a lot of guys out there that if they were really pissed off about their playing time, and if they were in the middle of their prime and they weren't getting the playing time and they were auditioning for free agency, that they would probably take it out on their coach very subtly in the press, but nobody's done it. And guys like Gerald Wallace, who, I mean, maybe Gerald Wallace knows that his career is pretty much over, but you watch him out there and he barely can move around out there. But if you put Gerald Wallace on a playoff team, he'd probably be a valuable 10th man off the bench. But Gerald Wallace hasn't really said a peep complaining about the fact that he's been pretty much removed from the roster and is just a glorified assistant coach. And I think it speaks a lot to Stevens is incredibly upfront and honest with his players. He never tells a player that he's going to play or he's not going to play. So a lot of the time players will play 30 minutes in the game that weren't really playing before. And we'll ask them, like, what did Stevens tell you before the game? And they'll be like, Stevens didn't say anything. You got to suit up every single day. And I think that's part of Stevens' philosophy, that he wants these guys to be practicing every single day like they might get a chance to play. Because James Young wasn't playing literally at all, and he kept getting sent down to the D League. But James Young said that he kept practicing as hard as he could every single day just because he knows that he never knows when his chance is going to happen. And sure enough, it happened for him.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. I think that's definitely interesting. One of the things I thought would be a fun exercise with all this is we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but to go through the transactions that have happened and just kind of get your thoughts on it from covering the team. And so the first one that really set a lot of these chains in motion was the Rajon Rondo trade. Were you happy with the return that Boston got on that?
No, nobody in the world was happy with that. I mean, that was kind of... I think when I saw the trade, I just tweeted out jaw on floor in all caps because I could not comprehend the idea that Rajon Rondo could be dumped for a couple bench players and a late first round draft pick. And then, you know, almost immediately I realized, you know what, that's actually probably the best that they were going to get in this situation. And there was so much dissecting about the history of Rondo and his value and all that kind of stuff at when the Celtics should have traded him. And, I mean, what really happened was the Celtics were going to give it a try to rebuild around him, and the ACL tear just ruined everything for that. And it's unfortunate, but it was just kind of a simple accident that really threw a wrench in everything. And they were hoping that Rondo would come back this year, and he would be a world beater and be the guy that they always wanted him to be, and that just didn't happen. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I would say it's as much the team around him as Rondo himself. But Rondo, I called on him for a long time to be an aggressive scorer, be an aggressive leader on the court. And while he was a wonderful passer, he's still the way he played this year. He had like a different mannerism to the way he was playing this year. I noticed that he kind of liked to stand up straighter, maybe even sitting back a little bit. And instead of attacking lanes, he would run pick and rolls and he would try to sit back in the lane and then fire in a rifle pass. And it was getting picked off all the time. There were lots of deflections. He was turning it over pretty much more than any – compared to the amount of – compared to his usage rate, he was turning it over just as – probably more than any other year in his career. And Rondo just didn't look like he was the guy that they wanted him to be anymore. And the rest of the league saw that, and the market responded pretty much as you could imagine. So – you know, they took Brandon Wright. They turned him into a potential first-round pick, but most likely two second-round picks. They traded Nelson and then bought out Nate Robinson. So they basically cut Nelson. And they still have Jay Crowder, who is a really solid bench player, who right now is starting for this team, and he's playing pretty solidly. He works his butt off defensively. He's inconsistent offensively, but he contributes sometimes. And then they got that first-round pick that's not going to be worth too much, but they can use it as a trade package piece sometime in the next 2 years. But you look at that and you think about basically two guys that you dumped for second-round picks and then a solid bench player for a guy that was a top 10 player in the league just a couple years ago. But Rondo's career has taken a major, major drop, and we'll see if he can get it back together in Dallas. I mean, he's looked decent in Dallas so far. I know he's really improved the way they're playing on the defensive side, which is hilarious considering all the talk about how he hasn't been trying defensively for the Celtics for a while. But, you know, Rondo, he's a guy that thrives on the big stage, and it kind of looks like he's a guy that only really gives it his all on the big stage. And I think that's what really separated him from the great players in the league, was that he didn't really want to, he wasn't really committed to being a great player every single night. And especially when you're the point guard and the ball's in your hand 90% of the time, that's going to destroy your team. And that's what happened with Rondo. And I think everybody in – I would assume everyone in the front office is a little bit disappointed that it just – he didn't really reach the heights that they wanted him to reach on an individual level. But, you know, he can still go to Dallas and win 3 NBA titles and looked at as one of the great point guards ever. I mean, it can all change for him. But the difference was he had the chance to be the guy, and it was pretty apparent that he just isn't the guy.
Yeah, I think that the Rondo story kind of hinges with the ACL injury, because that was the chance to really see it and also to rehabilitate his value around the league. But the small component of that trade that I really liked for the Celtics is that they put playoff protection on the pick for this year. So in effect, what they were betting on was that, okay, in one of the next couple of years, they'll fall off. And if they fall off, they won't ever have one of the 5-6 worst records. I think that's pretty well agreed to. They have a really good team. So they're making that bet, and by securing the playoff part this year, said, okay, well, we're not making that bet for this year. I think they expected they're going to make the playoffs this year, which they probably will. And then so they gave themselves a much better chance of getting a good pick. It still isn't a great chance, but it's better. And when you're Boston and you're trying to get as many assets as you can, that kind of small tweak could make a huge difference.
Well, I mean, with the Celtics, they've got so many of their draft picks that are or their incoming pick protections that are going to divert to second rounders that they're basically just going to be picking up a bunch of like little players around out the back end of their roster towards the second round. And those are guys that get cut all the time, because with second round picks, they're out of there in 2 years a lot of the time. So they're looking at it as they've got all these first round picks that are going to be towards the end of the round. And then they've got those Brooklyn picks. With the way that they're set up, they're going to be pretty high, most likely, as the burning of Brooklyn continues. So they're probably looking at it as everything they acquire is probably going to get moved out, because they've got their picks and they got the Brooklyn picks to be kind of the guys that they really build their roster with. So when I see all these draft picks they're picking up, I'm looking at those as most likely things that they're trying to use to trade off in the future. Because the amount of draft picks they have, they're not going to use the majority of those, because you only get 15 guys on your roster, and there's no point in having 15 first round picks. It's more valuable to trade those picks. And Danny Ainge was saying recently in an impromptu press conference after the Jeff Green trade that draft picks are more valuable as assets before the pick, because you can trade it to any team and they can do whatever they want with them. So his philosophy is starting to kind of reveal itself, is that he doesn't want players to trade. He wants picks to trade, because teams want the flexibility of getting whoever they want with that draft pick rather than being locked in trying to make a player fit into the team. Because if you're looking at it from like a risk management perspective, when you have a draft pick, every single team in the league wants that draft pick. There's not a single team in the league that couldn't use that pick. While if you have Jeff Green, there is only about 4 teams in the league really that could use Jeff Green. So Angel's looking at just utilizing as much flexibility as humanly possible. So for him, he'd rather have than like a maybe like a 6-man. He would rather have a late first round pick, just because there are more teams in the league that would want that pick than a good 6-man.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a logic to that, and we know that you can combine picks to move up. You can look at something like what Chicago did to get Doug McDermott, and you can argue about whether that was good or not. And the other component of that is the Celtics have had a lot of trouble drafting late in the first round, so maybe thinking about it as combining assets is a better use of their drafting talent.
The thing is, so the Celtics also moved up in the draft recently to take Kelly Olynyk. Now, they could have taken Giannis Antetokounmpo if they hadn't moved up, or if they moved up, they could have taken him instead. So it kind of shows the risk in making draft picks. And that's why I've traditionally been against draft picks, is because you don't know, while you know you can choose who you want, you're also taking a risk in that you don't know who that player is yet. And now Kelly Olynyk at the 13th pick in that draft is still looking like a pretty good pick. As inconsistent as he is, he's showing that he's got a good amount of talent. But everybody missed there where they didn't draft Giannis, because Giannis is very clearly a top 3 or 4 pick in that draft. And it shows that while you're mitigating risk as far as who would want the picks, you're also increasing the risk of not knowing what you're getting. And Danny Ainge believes in himself and his staff enough that he'd rather have the picks, I guess. But, and of course, it's all looking at a ideal trade for a superstar at some point. Maybe he wants, like LaMarcus Aldridge or something like that. Who knows? Or Kevin Durant, but that's probably not going to happen. But the point being is that Ainge I mean, Ainge is never scared of taking a risk, but I think he's scared of not being able to make a move. And with him, when he has all these draft picks, I think he probably looks at it as he can move up in the draft whenever he wants, which is probably ideal. And he can move them to and package for trade whenever he wants for another player as well. But Ainge just always wants to be able to make a trade. He wants to be able to blow everything up whenever he wants. And I'm not saying that in a petulant way. I'm saying is that he values the flexibility of the roster and his assets more than anything.
Can I mention that I'm pretty sure with the picks that they gave up for Olynyk that they also could have gotten Rudy Gobert, which would have been an amazing combination for Boston?
I mean, they would have. That would have been the longest team in NBA history if you put, just from a wingspan position, you put Rondo, Bradley, Green, Giannis, and Gobert on the floor together. All those guys have a wingspan of like 7 feet plus. I mean, that would have been remarkable to watch.
Is there anybody that you have? I don't know if you've watched much college, but is there anybody that you've sat there and gone, oh, they'd be really fun on this team?
Well, Jahlil Okafor, obviously. I mean, there's no question that the only thing that the Celtics want right now is just to get Jahlil Okafor. It's like he would solve every single problem that they have. They would have everything that they want in one package. There's a lot of centers towards the top of the draft coming up here that the Celtics want. They want a center, which is funny considering that Tyler Zeller has been fantastic for him and probably one of the best value players in the NBA right now, considering the production that he's been giving them throughout most of the season and the fact that they got him for a trade exception. That worked out pretty incredibly for them. But he's not incredibly consistent as far as being an effective player. He's been sitting out a lot of second halves lately because there's games where Zeller works and then there's games where he doesn't work. And of course, without Rondo now, it's definitely inhibited his game. But they're looking at, you know, there's Towns at Kentucky, Cauley-Stein at Kentucky. I don't really know a ton about Porzingis, but I know he's a guy that's probably going to be on their radar. And they could look at another swingman too. And there's a lot of good swingman and Winslow and Johnson from Arizona. The Barcelona kid too. So there's a lot of guys at the top of the draft that would work for them, and you know they could go for a swingman. James Young is nice, but he's not exactly Giannis. So if they see that like a guy that they think is going to be a super athletic freak or be a great all around scorer, they'd probably go for him. But there's no question that they want that number one pick. They want Okafor. Okafor, like Embiid was before the injury last year, before he put on 50 pounds reportedly. Okafor was the dream. I'm sorry. Embiid was the dream for them. And Okafor is probably not quite as good, at least on paper, but he's probably pretty comparable. Okafor is definitely what they need. So I think the Celtics right now, they're looking at it as we just got to win the lottery this year. That's all that matters.
I'll give you another one. I haven't watched much of him this year. Not if they get a really good pick, but if they fall down a little bit like they did last year. A guy that I think would be really fun on the Celtics is Mario Hezonja. And Hezonja is not getting a lot of press because he plays in Europe, and that happens a lot. But the guy that I'd compare him to is a less crazy J.R. Smith. And some people will see that and shudder, and I understand why. But if you think about if you restarted J.R. Smith's career with his physical talent and his shooting ability 100 times, you would end up with a pretty good NBA player, I would say at least 60 of those times.
Yeah, well, I mean, J.R. Smith is like an absolute nut job. So we can compare guys to J.R. Smith as far as their game is concerned and then not say that that's like a negative thing. Just because with J.R. Smith, it's like great score and then add the caveat of being a total nut job. And Hezonja, who is the Barcelona kid, but I didn't want to try to screw up his name and humiliate him on the Real GM podcast, but he's a good shooter, and that's something that the Celtics want really badly. They literally, right now on this team, the only guy that can really take a shot for them, be like a shot maker, is Marcus Thornton. And that's really scary to say about an NBA roster. When Marcus Thornton, and not Marcus Thornton of 3 years ago when he was averaging 18 a game for Sacramento, but Marcus Thornton, that's pretty much almost on his way out of the league. And he's, and by the way, Marcus Thornton's in pretty lousy shape. And I've been really kind of, I wouldn't say surprised because I kind of expected something to be wrong with him. But Thornton, who I do like as a player, he is in pretty lousy shape. And I'm kind of, it's kind of noticeable, even though he still runs his butt off while he's out there. He definitely needs to lose a lot of weight. But you know, the Celtics, they, as badly as they need a center, they need a guy that's a shot maker for them. Marcus Smart is supposed to be a shot maker, but so far this year, he has barely even driven the ball into the paint. He's been almost allergic at driving to the paint, and no one's really sure why yet. It might have to do with his ankle injury that he suffered really early in the season, but he's shooting the ball from deep pretty decently. His 3-point shot is so much better than it was last year at Oklahoma State. So that's pretty great. But they need a guy that can be a shot maker for them. Moutier would make sense as well. And of course, I say that knowing that both Bradley and Smart, those are guys they can move on from. Nobody's really locked into this roster. So, yeah, I mean, the draft's kind of wide open for the Celtics at the top. If they're in the top five, they're going to get they can pretty much pick whoever they want as far as who they who fits with their team. But there's no question that Okafor is kind of a step ahead on what they need and who's better than everybody else in the draft.
You talked about it as a salary dump, but one of the pieces of the moves that they made that I liked the best actually was the trade with Jameer Nelson going for Nate Robinson to Denver, because Jameer had a player option next year that was, you know, it was about $3 million, I think, so there's a decent chance he was going to get it, and he didn't really have much utility for Boston, so they were able to get out of that without much of a commitment, when it could have been not a huge albatross, but a somewhat small albatross that would have caused them some problems.
Yeah, I mean, they just want to clear everything for next year, so it was a salary dump, and salary dump's a good thing. They were able to get rid of something that was going to be dead weight for them, and that worked out pretty nicely. So they didn't have to buy out the $6 million over 2 years. They just had to buy out the whatever prorated $2 million was left on Nate Robinson's contract. So, yeah, that worked out pretty well for them. And I was devastated that I didn't get to see Nate Robinson in a Celtics uniform, because it would have been, one, a shot maker that they need, and two, just a really fun experience. Although I've heard negative things about Nate Robinson as a human being in the locker room having to work with. But the Celtics, they're doing a nice job of just getting rid of everybody, and they're looking at this roster and they're saying, you know, there's nobody here we really want. You know, there's some of these guys that we need to win right now, but we don't really want to win right now. So they got rid of Jeff Green. They have a future first round pick coming. It's in 2019, most likely. So they could be a valuable pick at that point, assuming that things don't go well for Memphis in the future. I mean, Randolph's old. Gasol is probably still going to be around at that point if they're able to keep him, and still probably be an all-NBA player. And Mike Conley should still be an all-star player at that point. Jeff Green, I'm not really going to put any stock into his future. I mean, I've let my thoughts on Jeff Green be pretty widely known. I've been very disappointed in him as a player, but him as a fourth or fifth man in a starting lineup is a pretty good player, and it's probably the right role for him. But he was another guy that had a chance to be a 20-point machine for the Celtics on a bad team, and he couldn't even fill that. So my faith in Jeff Green to grow as a player is pretty much gone. But the Celtics, these protections, like you were alluding to earlier, it could set them up for something really great down the road. And a lot of them are protected in the front end and the back end, so it's really just kind of middle of the draft setup. But the Memphis one, though, is set up so that it could be a really good pick for them if it comes in 2019, which is when it's unprotected.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And the other nice thing for the Celtics is that, as we've talked about, they have so few set pieces, so they can go pretty straight best player available for whatever they're doing. And that's also true for free agency. You know, if they're a good guy comes up, they can't be like, oh, well, you would be blocked by this guy, or you would be blocking this guy. So they can just do what's best for them, hope that somebody jumps there, you know, maybe, I don't know who it would be, whether it be Kevin Love or Hibbert or somebody, you know, hope that somebody comes up, or in 2016 when they're really flush with cash, that they can do it then. And, you know, it's the whole goal is to get three guys. And so the hope would be to develop one from who you already have, to get a second in the draft, and to get a third either through a trade or free agency. And one of the things that I like about where Boston is that I think while they don't have any of those guys right now, they have a lot of arrows in the quiver that could maybe do it.
So the restricted free agency class this year is going to bear out a little bit differently, because last year you had Parsons and you had Hayward, who were two players that weren't max players yet, but they had the potential to be. And with the TV money going up and the cap going up, those deals were going to be pretty fair in a couple of years. But this year you have guys that the Celtics would obviously give an arm and a leg for: Jimmy Butler, Kawhi Leonard, Marc Gasol. Those are all guys that are playing so well already that there's no question that they're max players, and there's going to be no qualms for those teams, for their own teams wanting to match there. It looks like Chicago will be able to pull off the match. It looks like San Antonio will, and of course Memphis is going to. So the Celtics can't really outbid anybody, even though they have the cap space to outbid people for really great restricted free agents. They're not going to be able to do it this year. So they're really looking ahead to 2016, where the cap is going to go up even more, and their gigantic cap figure or cap space, which is going to be maybe as high as 50 or even 60 million in 2016, that's going to allow them to potentially do some outbidding when the max contracts go way up. So I wouldn't be surprised to see 2015 in the offseason be kind of a dead offseason for them. And I don't think they're desperate enough to like make an offer on Tristan Thompson or something like that. I don't think Kevin Love's going to hit the market. I think he's probably going to wait till 2016 to hit the market. And then they'll see what they can do there. But I've got enough faith in the talent that they have in Cleveland that they're going to be able to pull that off, and that team isn't going to be disbanding in 2 years.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that. And it's going to be a challenge for any team to pull somebody away. But at the same time, the gigantic question mark with everything with these guys is that they're going to have a lot of options, because in 2016 in particular, there are going to be a lot of teams with space. And so the hope for Boston has to be to have somebody develop, ideally with their own draft pick. I think that's their best chance to say, you can play with this guy. That's why Gio Okafor is such an interesting fit there, is that, hey, you can play with him as a sales pitch to somebody, or Moutier, or Karl Towns, who I actually like a lot. And I like Willie Cauley-Stein, but I don't think Cauley-Stein's going to draw people to play with him necessarily.
No.
But so you want that guy so that when 2016 rolls around, that you're in the conversation. And once you're in the conversation, you have that chance, you have the history and all that. I think that you can do that. But they're going to the problem that they're going to face is it's possible that a team like the Wizards could have max space, or a team like maybe – well, the Warriors probably won't if everything goes the way everybody expects. But, you know – a team that already has a pretty good situation. But there are going to be so many guys that are going to be available that there's going to be an option there. And it's going to be exciting to see. But then the other component of it is just how many assets they have. So maybe they do something more like what happened with James Harden, where the other team made a mistake. He shouldn't have been on the market. And Houston was able to take advantage of that by putting together a pretty good offer that was the best offer on the table. And they got a guy who never should have been available. And you do that, and then that's your one. And I have no idea who that'll be, but I think it could happen.
Could be Goran Dragic. That's a guy that I wouldn't be surprised to see coming to Boston this year. And I think that'd be great if they could bring him in. But you're right. There's not that one guy that looks like he could be available. I mean, the thing is, the Harden thing happened kind of under the dark in the middle of the night, where no one really saw it coming that clearly. It was kind of a surprise, especially the timing right before the season. Those trades are always big shockers. But Dragic is probably the guy that makes sense for him to be the one that happens to. LaMarcus Aldridge, there was some potential for that to happen, but that team is so good that there's just no way in hell they're going to make that move, because they're serious title contenders. So right now, and of course, DeMarcus Cousins was a guy maybe a little while ago that could have happened with, but he's gotten so good that even despite the fact that the temper issues are still kind of popping up from time to time, there's just no way Sacramento's going to make that move. So I don't see anybody that the Celtics could be the team that like swoops in and makes that move. But if you compare the Harden package, the Celtics have those kind of players. They have those draft picks. There's no question about that. But they can offer up one or two good young players with a draft pick, and they can make a swoop for a big star anytime they want. There's no question they could pull that off. And you know, OKC, that James Harden trade is extremely – it's one of the most fascinating trades that I can remember seeing in a while. And looking back at it now, the fact that they turned Jeremy Lamb into Dion Waiters, they pretty much ended up getting what they were hoping to get Jeremy Lamb, and they got him and Dion Waiters. So you look at Dion Waiters and Steve Adams now together, that trade worked out pretty similar to what they were expecting it to work out to. And of course, they drafted Reggie Jackson, that made it look a lot better. So it worked out pretty decently for OKC. And I'm sure that allows teams to feel that they could make that similar move with the Celtics, and it could work out pretty okay for them.
Yeah, that's definitely lingering in the background. I was thinking about two non-Celtics things that I was amused by. One of them is that right now the Knicks are exactly halfway through the season, and they're 5-36, and to hit their over on over-under, they would need to go 36-5. So it's just, you know, kind of where they are and everything like that. And then the other one is the possibility that the Lakers have to give up their pick this year, because they're right on the fringe of it. Incidentally, Boston's a team that could totally screw the Lakers if that happened.
That would be pretty amazing to see. And it's really fun to see the Lakers and the Celtics make a fight for the fourth and fifth pick in the draft. I mean, that's it's a really amazing how parity really is working in the NBA. But Yeah, the Knicks being 5-36, being three and a half games right now behind Philadelphia in the standings, and Philadelphia's roster is like one of the worst we've ever seen. It really is an absolute testament to Carmelo Anthony as a human being and a player. I mean, Carmelo Anthony, who was left on an island for a while with this team, and then of course things have really fallen apart for him and he's out, and now they've lost 16 in a row. But Melo could have been in Chicago or Houston, two of the best teams in the league, and he chose to play it out in New York, and they're the worst team, one of the worst teams of all time now. I mean, that 1-2-2 winning percentage, they could break the record this year. And of course that would be without Melo for the most part, but, and Melo should shut it down, by the way. There's no point of Carmelo Anthony playing basketball in the NBA for the New York Knicks right now. But it's amazing how big of a mistake Carmelo Anthony made from a basketball perspective. But he did come out in an interview and say that one of the reasons, and I'm doing air quotes in my room right now, one of the reasons why he wanted to go to New York was because of he's trying to be like a millionaire now, where he has culture and he's a part of New York society and he collects art and all that kind of stuff, which I totally respect and understand. But if I were in his shoes as someone that likes all that kind of stuff, I would have rather gone to Chicago, which is my second favorite city in America, and have most of that stuff, most of that culture life, but still have been on a great team and win NBA championships. And of course, when you become a more successful NBA champion, that allows you to kind of transcend boundaries and, you know, be a global superstar. So Melo, I think, made a terrible miscalculation there. Maybe he wanted the money. I don't think the money was that big of an issue for him. It seems like he makes plenty of money already, that is, especially because if he started winning titles, he'd be making more money that way than if he got the extra $30 million from New York. But it's, when I look at New York, I look at this sad, sad team, but I really just look at what I think is a terrible mistake that Melo made to not go to Houston or Chicago.
And at the same time, I talked about this a little bit with Nate Duncan last week, the mistake that the Knicks made was that they did both the big offer and the no trade. And if they had offered one or the other, they still would have had the best offer on the table, but they wouldn't have trapped themselves. And the big issue with that is that, you know, they need to convince Melo to waive his no trade, so he still wields a ton of power. And that is a really big challenge for them, because they can't move in a different direction unless he's willing to do it too.
Yeah, but doesn't the 5-36 record pretty much effectively waive his no trade clause? Don't you think that Melo wants to get out of here now?
I think that he gets the leverage to say, I want to go here. And also, that means that the Knicks will get a much worse return in the trade, because he can exert that power, and he obviously wants his new team to be as good as they can be. Presumably, though, he didn't do that when he went to the Knicks. He deliberately made the team worse by choosing to go when he went to get more money. So I don't know how much he really values that. But at the same time, you know, the hard thing with Melo is you can justify what he did. I mean, the Knicks made an offer they shouldn't have made. He got the money that he wanted, and if that was his priority, that was his priority. But what I hope, and I always hope this, it's the same thing with Kobe, is that you just own it, that you wear it. And if you do that, then I'm going to be fine with it. I'm never going to knock somebody for taking $10 million more dollars a year. I can't do it. I'm not that person. I don't have the wherewithal. I don't have the ability to tell somebody you shouldn't do that. But at the same time, I can say that just own it. I chose the money. That was my decision. And it doesn't matter if he admits it was a mistake or not. That's immaterial. But that you just know that it is what it is, and we can all move on from there.
Yeah, I mean, when I was criticizing him for taking the money, I mean, I don't criticize him for wanting more money. I mean, if I were in his position, I would take that money, but I would take that money in a way that would benefit me the most.
Yeah.
I look at it as that if I go to Chicago and I win a bunch of titles, I'm going to make more money in endorsements and all sorts of other stuff, and even championship bonuses and stuff like that. And I, in the long run, would probably out earn my $30 million bonus bump that I'm getting by going to the Knicks. So I think it probably, I think that players might be a little bit short-sighted when they want to go for the hometown max, because if they're going to go to a team that's not going to be that successful, they probably could make more money off the court if they are more successful in the long run. And Melo, of course, is a huge superstar, so it's not like he isn't going to be able to attract more endorsement deals and stuff like that. So And of course, there's like royalties from all the stuff that, from your winnings. And all, you know, there's a lot of money to be made by winning an NBA title. And I mean, for him, it's really just a matter of what does he want in his life? Does he want to be a great NBA legend, or does he want to be a society legend? And I think it's probably the latter for him. And whatever makes him happy in the end is what matters. I mean, NBA players don't have to be great NBA legends that we can all remember fondly. You know, some of them can just enjoy their lives and not really care too much about how the world remembers them exactly, because maybe they don't care as much about how every other podcaster out there feels about them as much as, I don't know, how Warren Buffett feels about them as a businessman. You know, like, there's people that watch basketball assume that every single player is out there to serve their need to enjoy basketball, but those people are all out there living their lives. And Carmelo Anthony is a guy that's out there living his life, trying to be the king in New York. And he is enjoying that a lot more than being remembered fondly as a great NBA player, or so I'm presuming. And it's a unfair presumption to make. And I'm not going to say it's absolutely official, but that's what the perception seems to be. And that's what matters for Melo, is just whatever makes him and his family happy. And don't forget, his wife has a very successful career as well, and it seems to be pretty much based on being in New York and LA, so that's another major factor there. And a lot of people have to choose their jobs based on their family and their spouse's work as well, and that's what Melo might have done as well. So, you know, being in New York, losing on his basketball team, that definitely has an impact on his life, but it might have less of an impact than it would for, say, Kevin Garnett, who basketball is life for him.
How crazy would it be if, what, right around when Kobe's expiring / retiring, if they either did a Melo for Kobe trade, or the Knicks traded Melo to the Lakers right after Kobe retired, if they struck out on Durant?
I honestly think that could be the most likely outcome. I kind of do expect, if New York can't turn it around, I do expect Carmelo Anthony to be a Laker in a couple of years. The Lakers will pretty much use their cap space to absorb him. They'll probably throw in a pick here or there. I don't think the Lakers have a single player on the roster that the Knicks would want to take back, and the Knicks would just want to clear out their cap. So I wouldn't be surprised in 2016 if Carmelo is with the Lakers and Kobe's assistant coach or even head coach. And by the way, I would really hope that Kobe Bryant coaches Carmelo Anthony. That would be what Carmelo needs and would just be what America needs in general. But I mean, that would work out really well, wouldn't it?
Are you saying that your dream is something other than Kobe and Shaq co-owning an NBA team? Because I don't think I can wish for anything more than that.
Well, no, Kobe and Shaq co-coaching. It would be the first co-head coaching setup in the league. That would be really great.
What about J.R. Smith player coaching?
I mean, that would be pretty fun, I guess. I think that would be more fun than like soccer. Just because, you know, in soccer, it's like the manager doesn't have a lot of interaction with the team. So it's really just him on the field controlling everything. While in the NBA, there's a little bit more player interaction. So I'd like to see J.R. Smith in like soccer being a player manager. But yeah, that would probably, if you want to talk about what would be the most disastrous player coach in the league, I'd say J.R. Smith would probably be number one.
Now I really want to think about who I would have on that list. I mean, Lance would definitely be in the conversation.
Yeah, he'd be right there, yeah.
And Dion Waiters would probably be in the conversation too, because Dion Waiters thinks that he's the best player on every team he's on, it seems like. And that, or at least he's a part of the key of the best team, and considering he was on the Cavs and is now in the Thunder, that's a very fun thing to imagine.
Well, like with Dion Waiters, I think it's going to bear out to see. Is he going to be J.R. Smith, or is he going to be Jamal Crawford? Because like Smith and Crawford are pretty similar when they were younger. You know, they would have 40-point games once in a while. They were kind of head cases. They were uncontrollable. Crawford really got his stuff together, while Smith just never got it together. And of course, Crawford's a little bit older than Smith, so Smith has some time. But in Crawford, it seemed like his career was kind of falling apart at one point, the way that Smith's is, before he got it back together. And now he's revered as one of the best six men around. But I feel like Waiters is going to be somewhere between those two guys, because as soon as he was drafted, it was very apparent that he was going to be a gunner that wasn't going to fit in too well in the NBA, was a terrible choice next to Kyrie Irving. And there was no question in my mind that Harrison Barnes was the pick to make there, and they blew it so monumentally, I can't believe it. But you know, Waiters, he's going exactly. And you know what, Waiters, he's going to be a 16-point scorer a night kind of guy, but he's just not going to be a valuable player. He's not going to be an overall plus player on your team. And it worked out. I mean, OKC made the right move in getting him. And if they can get Brook Lopez, which we haven't even talked about yet somehow, I really, really am scared of OKC. And that could make them the best team in basketball if Lopez can stay healthy. But you know, Deion Waiters is another one of those guys that just goes to show that if you're just a scorer in the NBA and that's all you can do, then no one's going to really want you, and you're just not going to be a valuable player.
Two basic points when you were talking about the guys to compare him to. Mine is another Jay Crawford. I think he's similar to Jordan Crawford in a lot of senses, that he's going to need the right coach, but that he's going to wear out his welcome. But I think he'll stay in the league longer than Jordan has. I also think Jordan's going to be back in the league. The other thing that's funny is I was thinking about it because when you and I met was covering the 2012 draft, and I was thinking back on Drummond, and I don't know if you were there for this, but one of my favorite conversations I've been a part of in terms of that kind of open press availability was somebody asked Drummond why he was so bad at free throws, and he went on this thing, and his basic answer was, "I don't know, man. You know, like, I was good at them in high school, and for whatever reason, it fell apart." And it's really funny to think about now. That's like, it's a really honest answer, but at the same time, it's more than a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, Andre Drummond has gotten so big since he was like a sophomore in high school. I mean, that could just be a matter of just him kind of, his hands kept getting bigger and bigger, and he lost control of his shot, or he just stopped practicing his free throws. Who knows? But you know, that happens with a lot of big guys where they're just too big. It's the whole tennis ball or orange thing with Shaq that he talked about. You know, some big men just can't shoot free throws and they get by. And there's been a lot of great big men in NBA history that couldn't shoot free throws. I mean, Will Chamberlain was one of the best ever, and he couldn't hit a free throw to save his life. So, you know, that's kind of just part of the game with the center. And I never have much of an issue with centers that can't hit free throws. They usually make up for it, that it doesn't, it really makes a little impact for them.
Okay, question for you. If you could pick, it has to be realistic, so you can't like throw the Celtics in as the 4 seed or whatever, but if you could pick any single first round playoff matchup, what would you most want to see?
It actually could happen, but I think Golden State San Antonio probably be the top for me. I mean, really anything with Golden State. I really love their matchups against the Clippers, but it looks like the Clippers they're not going to fall that far down. Right now, Phoenix is a game and a half behind San Antonio for the 8th seed, but to see those two teams play each other would just be a blessing. I mean, honestly, it's just two of the most beautiful offenses to watch in probably the last 15 years or so. I love Golden State. I've been a huge Golden State fan ever since the We Believe team and that Baron Davis dunk on Andre Kirilenko. That's still one of my favorite plays of all time. But this new iteration of the Warriors is just so much fun to watch. And Steve Kerr has done such a tremendous job with this team. And and what really makes me appreciate Steve Kerr is how some of these guys, especially Bogut, have been subtly coming out and taking shots at Mark Jackson. Meanwhile, in Cleveland, there's all these rumors that Rich Paul is trying to put Mark Jackson in charge there, which would be amazing considering that Jackson just got run out of town in Golden State. But you would definitely know more about that than I would. I like want to hear more from you about that right now. But I love what Steve Kerr has done with this team. This Golden State team is pretty much, they're kind of epitomizing our hopes and dreams of what they could be 2 years ago when they started this Steph Curry focused team. And you look at how great of a player Klay Thompson is becoming, and which has been remarkable to see. I mean, Klay Thompson's really turning into a special player, and he's almost on Steph Curry's level at this point. But they have put together such a great team, and to see the fact that they could handle Spates filling in there for Bogut, I still can't believe how well that's working out. Mo Spates is becoming the player that we thought he could be 5 years ago, and we kind of laughed at ourselves thinking, wow, Mo Spates, what a disappointment. And now we're seeing what he's doing. It's incredible.
I can't believe you might bait me into talking about this, but to me, the question with Mark Jackson is how much does he want to be an NBA coach? Because something that you and I both know, being around the league and all that, is that being an NBA coach and being an NBA assistant, it's a lot of work, and it requires having a really thick skin, because you need to have smart voices around you, which is one of the biggest things that I will credit Steve Kerr with, is that Kerr had absolutely no problem having a lot of talent in his coaching ranks. He has guys who probably were definitely more qualified to be the Warriors coach than him, and Ron Adams and Alvin Gentry. And he was able to put them in, and that the big difference between Mark Jackson and Steve Kerr is that Kerr took, I would say it's kind of the intellectual approach to it, and that is, okay, what is the best system I can build with the guys that we have? Whereas Mark Jackson's was, how can I put my system with these guys? And the hilarious part about Mark Jackson going to Cleveland is, that's another team with lots of unique talent. And the worst thing you can do with unique talent is put them into a cookie cutter box that was from the 80s or 90s when they didn't have those unique talents. Those Knicks teams were wonderful, and the Pacers teams were wonderful, but they didn't have those guys in the same sense. I mean, you could say Reggie, but Reggie wasn't Stephen Curry. Reggie wasn't LeBron James. And so his ethos is so opposing and kind of diametrically so what the Cleveland Cavaliers should do with Kevin Love, who is just this amazing talent who you can use in a lot of different ways, much less LeBron James, who is one of the more distinct stars in the history of the NBA.
Well, I mean, just starting with Mark Jackson, I've heard a lot about just Mark Jackson basically not kind of being maybe like a glorified representative of what an NBA coach should be, but he wasn't that legit of a coach. He was really, I've heard some people tell me that he was really more of like a just try to give you a rah-rah speech and not really do the work that was required to be a legitimate NBA coach and to run a legitimate NBA franchise. And a lot of players got tired of it, that because it's kind of, I mean, like that stuff kind of is BS and people see through it eventually. And especially when you're on a good team where these guys feel like they're getting held back by the coach. And I mean, I know that Mark Jackson's a preacher and everything. That's kind of just as the way that he works on a fundamental level. But it sounds like he needed to kind of step up his act a little bit to be an NBA coach. And of course, when I try to talk to him at press conferences, I felt like I was talking to like an old record on repeat or something like that. I mean, you would try to ask him a question and he would give you like a dead-eyed stare into space and give you some sort of pre-written preacher line. And it was so aggravating. I mean, I didn't talk to him that much. So I'm sure you talked to him more than I did, but it seemed like there was a lack of sincerity behind what he was doing that probably held him back more than anything.
Yeah, well, the issue with Mark is that he was a great leader of men, an absolutely fabulous leader of men, but he wasn't the tactician or kind of coach in that sense that the Warriors team needed, and he didn't acknowledge that flaw by building a staff around him that could build with that weakness. And so that's how everything went, and I think for guys like Steph and Clay and everybody, they were really mad when he left because they had developed a personal connection. He was important to them, and Mark Jackson was important to their development as human beings, more so than as basketball players. But to me, what happened this year, and you saw it more with guys like Bogut, who had less positive relationships with Mark Jackson than Stephen Curry did, and also is way more open to being critical than Stephen Curry is, because Curry's a pro dealing with the media, is that I don't think they realized or appreciated that the tactical part, the development part, is so much more important. Because you can have leaders on your team, but you can't really have tacticians in the same way. I mean, there are teams that have coaches on the floor. The Wizards have a couple now with Andre Miller, Paul Pierce. You know, you have Steve Nash for years was like that. And you have those examples. But what they needed was that person who could make them do it. And the other thing is that they had come from a place of such bad basketball that they were like, hey, we're playing really well. We're having a good time. We have this guy who we like personally. And now they go, oh, this is what we could have been. And so you see them and you see the players talk about, you know, like how fun it is to play like this. And one of the things that you get when you cover the league and remember also that these are human beings is winning feels really good. And these are human beings. And if you imagine that you're a rare job where you can put your wins and losses on the court and you can put it on the newspaper every day. Most of us can't do that. That really affects your life, and it affects how you interact with other people, that, you know, when you walk around the city that you live in, people will be like, hey, you know, because your team has only lost 6 games all year. So I think that they never really had the opportunity to see the full picture, and that has really opened them up to what they were missing, but they could never appreciate because they never had it.
Well, so, I mean, I'm criticizing Mark Jackson as how he could be as an NBA coach. But the thing is that Mark Jackson probably was the right guy for this team at the moment, and that they needed someone to develop this team, right? And Mark Jackson is a people person. He's someone that he took Klay Thompson, he took Steph Curry, he made them feel comfortable with themselves, he made them not worried about the flaws in their game, but rather to enhance what's great about their game, which is shooting and all that stuff, and he made them great at what they do, and in turn, they got better overall as players. And maybe Mark Jackson, I'm not saying maybe, I see it as that Mark Jackson was the reason why they got to where they were getting. But Mark Jackson just wasn't – he was, because you're right. You need to develop the team, and then you need to take them over the top by building something great with them. And Mark Jackson is just not that guy. And Steve Kerr is that guy, and it's working perfectly for them. So they got the coach that they needed to develop the team, to get the players to learn how to be really good NBA players and believe in themselves. And it worked out really well for the most part. And then they got the guy that could really that really has the ingenuity to take it home. And that's why Andrew Bogut wasn't happy, because Andrew Bogut and Andre Iguodala are guys that are they're well established into their careers, and they don't need some guy preaching at them, teaching them how to be NBA players. They already are those players. They're already two of the fiercest competitors in the league. And that's what Curry and Thompson and Draymond Green and Harrison Barnes all needed. But the veterans obviously don't want that. And now they're happy because they've got a guy in Kerr that they can relate to and that they think is smart enough to really put them over the top. And it's working because those guys that were developing, they're developed now. And except for Draymond Green, who's starting to kind of we're seeing he's starting to kind of explode through the ceiling of what we thought was his glass ceiling there. But they are reaching a pinnacle that Jackson couldn't have brought them to, and Steve Kerr probably is going to be able to bring them to. And the question is, how much more can they grow? How healthy can Bogut stay? I mean, I know Bogut's back now. He's playing 25 minutes. He's not doing a ton of stuff yet, but it looks like he's probably going to be able to get back to being the 10-rebound, 2-block-a-night guy that he was earlier in the year.
Yeah, I think that you hit on a lot of it. I would also, the big thing I would mention with why Mark Jackson was important is defense. I think that he instilled not only the kind of the knowledge of kind of what to do, I think a lot of his defensive system is still in place. His defensive system. The defensive system that he was involved in installing. And also the idea that playing defense is really important, you know, that you need that as a component of winning. And then they got the talent in Andrew Bogut to surround it to make the effort part combine with the talent part. And that was always going to be necessary. So yeah, I think that you can make a really good argument that Jackson was a necessary component of this development, and he deserves that credit. But at the same time, that's kind of a weird thing. It's kind of a weird credit to give, because it was going to have to happen, and I'm happy it happened when it did. I honestly think it should have happened a year before to make the change, but it's hard to knock the process when the results are looking as good as they're going to be. And the other question you talked about, you know, how much better they can get is, can they get better talent-wise? Because if they can add one or two small pieces, you know, let's say in the 6 to 8 spots in the rotation, they could be even better than they are right now. And that's where the Spurs are and the Warriors are not, is that ridiculous comical depth that you can do. And if they can get one or two guys, maybe one of your former coveries, which is Kevin Garnett, then that would be huge for this team.
That would be huge, because they have Barbosa coming off the bench. They have Sean Livingston. Justin Holiday's getting some minutes for them too, right?
So he is. Yeah, he's blown up. The shocking part about him is he originally got in the rotation because of his defensive versatility, which is a storyline with this team, is that they can, in certain lineups, they can switch everything 2-4 or even 1-4 depending on how they play, or to 5 if they play Draymond at the 5. So Holiday fits in with that defensively. But what happened is they put him in and he kept on hitting shots. Yeah. And so he's basically bumped Barbosa largely out of the rotation, not entirely, but largely out of the rotation. And that's nice. I mean, it's nice to be able to get that guy. I don't think either Barbosa or Holiday is going to play very much in the playoffs, but you need those 10 minutes or 20 minutes a game, especially when you get in foul trouble, to do that. And when you think about a team like the Spurs, you know, that's what they're going to do. And it's exciting to see what they can do. But I still think there's one big move left in the Warriors if they want to do it. And the crazy one that I haven't shared, and I think it'll be fun with you because you and I have talked ridiculous trades like this before, is I'm wondering if things really fall apart with the Cavs, what the Warriors would have to give up to get Kevin Love. Because I think they could do it without giving up Steph, Clay, or Bogut. And that would be really fun. Or Draymond. That would be really fun.
No, if I'm the Cavs, and it sounds like Kevin Love's committed to staying the next year, I'm not trading Kevin Love unless I'm getting another star in return. I'd probably do it for Klay Thompson. I don't know if I don't think Klay Thompson would fit on the Cavs, though, considering they already have LeBron and Kyrie. But they, I mean, if I'm the Cavs, there's no way I'm moving Kevin Love right now. You're just not. he's a great player. He's only 25 or 26. There's no way he's getting traded again unless he tells a team, I'm not going to take my option. I'm probably going to walk. So I don't see that happening. But you are right in that Golden State probably could use one more trade. And I don't think anybody wants David Lee anymore, but if they can move David Lee, that'd be great. Iguodala is a guy that they could get away with moving, even though I still really like Iguodala, even though he's having a down year. I know his PER is like 10 right now, which is amazing. But there's no question Draymond Green has replaced Iguodala in that role. And Green, although Iguodala is a better offensive player, Green is just such an unbelievable all-around player. He could play any position on the court. It's incredible to see. And then Harrison Barnes is kind of turning into what Andre Iguodala was, and Harrison Barnes might become Andre Iguodala. So they don't have much of a need for him anymore. And they don't want to trade Andrew Bogut, but if they could get another center instead of Andrew Bogut, that might make sense for them. Bogut fits in really well with this team, but Bogut definitely is limited, and his health is always going to be a question mark. And if they lose Bogut, they're not going to survive in the playoffs again. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to win without him there. They need that great defensive anchor at center. And as much as I like Maurice Spates, and I'm really excited to see him playing good basketball for the first time ever, he's just not going to be the center that gets it done for them in the playoffs if they really want to win the title. So if they can make a move for another center, I don't really see a center out there that's worth making a move for. I don't think they want Roy Hibbert, but Hibbert's probably the only other guy out there that I think could make sense for them. They probably should make that move.
Yeah, I think there's something there. I really love Bogut with this team. I think that he fills a very specific role offensively and defensively. But yeah, I mean, they definitely have that potential. Well, thanks so much for taking the time, and enjoy a Sunday of football. This will come out after that, but it should be a fun day anyway.
Thanks so much, man. That was a lot of fun.
Take care, man. Thanks again to Jared Weiss for taking the time to come on. You can listen to him on the Garden Report post-game show, and he also covers the Celtics for CLNS Radio and Celtics Blog. And you can also follow him on Twitter at @CLNS_JaredWeiss, JaredWeiss. I really liked having him on because it's fun to talk about the Celtics and to get into things like that with somebody who really knows that team. I'm hoping to do that a lot more. I'd like to do the Hawks at some point in the near future, maybe do the Raptors too, and I've done the Warriors so much that I'll probably try to hit somebody like Portland in the Western Conference and OKC, obviously, at some point. So if you have any guest ideas, I always appreciate that. Or any other comments, you can hit me up on Twitter at Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux. Or you can email me at daniel.larue@realgm.com. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.